Squadron Leader 4, Drill 4. If whilst you were on these curfew patrols in Jerusalem, you saw someone after the curfew hour, what would you have done?
Shot them.
You were under orders just to open fire?
Yes.
Did you give any warning?
Well, we would... actual oral warning, but very often, I mean, after all, we are humane, and very often the chap was just a wee bit late, 10 minutes or something, getting in, you know, and they, of course, you've got to remember, they didn't all have watches like we did, and it was very difficult for them. And there was, I can't remember that there was anything told or, you know, or any siren or anything went off, not as far as I can remember. But we did, we'd pop a couple over his head. You know, and then if he disappeared, well, we left it at that. But if there was any lurking or they looked a bit suspicious, or which sometimes we were quite a distance away from them. And it was a town after all, and you know how tricky it is in a town. You see a chap one and he's up a side street the next. But we would whop a few shots over. But if there was anything else, you know, if the chap lingered or had a gun with him or anything like that, we just used to shoot.
Did you ever have to do that in the event?
No, I didn't know, but I believe it was done. No, I had a fairly quiet trip on the curfew. Like the Nablus route was the worst route, but as far as Jerusalem was concerned, we were billeted in the King David Hotel there, and it was reasonably quiet. You know, just need to go out and do these curfews. You must realise I didn't go out every night. I went some nights. It just went out under a sergeant. We only had three cars. And they would do a kind of general tour around. We used to vary the district so that nobody knew where we were, of course. But we never had any trouble with mining or anything like that. In Jerusalem itself, it was just curfew mining, that's all, really.
Coming back to the Nablus route and working in the countryside, you've talked about being trapped on the buns, but couldn't you go cross country, or were you confined to roads?
You couldn't get off
the
buns, because the buns were so high and so steep that you couldn't take the cars off. They would just topple.
But, I mean, apart from when you were actually on a bund, I'm talking generally, could you not use the countryside, go cross country, or were you just confined to roads?
Not generally speaking, because there was such a lot of soft ground, and of course it wasn't mapped. That's the reason for the bund, to keep the ground, keep the road above the wet level. So it was rather like asking a train to get off the track and get back on it again. It just couldn't do it.
So you never left the roads?
Never left the roads. Not on some of these runs. If ever we could get out into the open, we did, because it was safer for us, and much better. We could actually, you see, armored cars never liked being compressed, or having their directions formulated by the circumstances. We used to like to be free ranging. Desert was our type of warfare. We got on the desert, we were okay. We could move out and alter our formations, again having to keep an eye open for soft patches, but there weren't an awful lot of soft patches in Iraq, and only in certain areas, and you were generally pretty safe, and you got a sixth instinct about these patches. Each car commander would instinctively put his head inside the turret and say, watch, there's a soft patch coming up on the right. You knew them, you see, and the driver would veer off a bit to the left and that kind of thing. But we did get caught now and again, of course.
How successful do you think the use of armoured cars was in the Palestine campaign?
I wouldn't say they were a great success, really. They were a bit too cumbersome for the whole thing. Had they been some of these modern... I think they were the Scarabs, were they, that came out afterwards? I can't remember now, but they had these wheels that were independently sprung, and they could go down off these banks and come back up again. I think it would have been a lot better, and they were much more manoeuvrable, but of course we hadn't got this. we were very fixed on a on this rigid based chassis, and we had very limited movement except backwards and forwards, or manoeuvring if we were on manoeuvrable ground. But on a thing like a button, you just couldn't manoeuvre at all. And we were very open to attack.
What did you and your comrades think of the people against whom you were fighting?
Well, the airmen had the usual idea, you know, bloody Arabs and bloody Jews. You know, what the hell are we mixed up with all this damn nonsense for? They didn't like it very much. Well, neither did we, but of course we had to keep our lip buttoned to being commissioned, you know. We were just carrying out orders. We don't like it any more than you do, but we're supposed to keep fairly neutral in this and, you know, just carry out instructions as far as they're given, and that's it. And, you know, we mustn't take sides. We mustn't, we certainly would have to be very careful about if the Jews, if we happen to know that a Jewish settlement was firing on some Arabs, we would certainly not have to, and, you know, we happen to be somewhere in between. We had to be careful that if we fired one way, we fired the other as well, or else we would be accused of partiality, if you know what I mean. We had to give a few bursts over that with that side with one or two machine guns, and a few bursts over this side, so they could never button down and say, well, why did the blasted armoured cars open up on us and not on the Jews who were shooting from the other side?
Did you get the impression whilst you were in Palestine that the civilian population were giving any voluntary help to the fighters?
I don't think so myself. Taken as a whole, I don't think they wanted to be any more involved in it than the civilians are in Northern Ireland at this present moment. You know, they were the radicals and the hotheads on both sides. The one wanted to see the other out, and they wanted to see the British out anyway. And I don't think that the ordinary man in the street, I mean, we used to walk about quite happily in uniform in places like Jerusalem and Nablus and so on, and nobody laid a finger on us or abused us or anything like that, you know, even though we weren't in the armoured cars. We were just walking around doing a bit of buying in the bazaars or whatever, or having an odd beer in a chaikana.
Were you RAF personnel in Palestine under the command of the army?
No, definitely not, no. It was all under the command of RAF Ram. It was either Ramley or Amman, I can't remember which. It was kind of thing between the two. Oh no, it was definitely all RAF. The only thing we did was to cooperate with the army. You see, the army weren't allowed in Iraq under the terms of the treaty. It was the mandate stipulated that the RAF could stay, but not the army. That's why the RAF ran the armoured cars in these two places. And I believe the same applied in Palestine, but you would need to check this. But Iraq was definitely a mandated territory.
Did the cooperation,
we were on sufferance.
Did cooperation with the army go smoothly, or were there any problems?
Oh, by and large, it was quite good. The army always thought themselves a wee bit superior to the RAF, but of course this is natural. I mean, in the same way the Navy thought they were a little bit above the two of them. You know, we're the senior service, and of course the British Army was very ancient and steeped in tradition, and the RAF was a baby. Of course it was a new thing. But, we got on quite amicably, really. No trouble.
So after your period in Palestine, did you then go back to Habaniya?
I went back to Habaniya, yes, or Habaniya, yes. Yes.
When did you leave Habaniya?
I left Habaniya. I've got all the details of this. I was ordered aboard a freighter leaving for Karachi on the 17th of June, 41. Do you want the details?
Mm-hmm.
I arrived Karachi on the 21st and left on the 22nd, which was the other one day. We got into Bombay on the 24th of June, stayed in the Taj Mahal Hotel, and left Bombay on the 27th of July. So we were there just over the month. I left on the Cape Town Castle. I was appointed ship's adjutant, arrived Colombo on the 30th of July, received a coded message at Colombo from Air Ministry ordering me to hold the ship, pending diversion and posting to Singapore, which fell a few days later. The order was cancelled by Air Ministry and we were told to proceed to UK because we had so many RAF personnel. We had 3,000 RAF on board, contingents of the King's African Rifles and Italian prisoners. While we were in Bombay, old Haw Haw got on the German radio, said he knew all our details and would be sinking us along the route, so that cheered us up a bit, you know. Anyway, from Colombo, we ran for Mombasa, this is on board the Cape Town Castle, and we arrived there on the 13th of August, left on the 21st of August. Arrived in Cape Town on the 24th of August. We were inoculated against Yellow Jack and went ashore for 2 days. Now, this is rather interesting. I climbed the Table Mountain on a day like this and saw a great armada of ships taking troops and equipment to the Middle East and India. It was a most impressive sight. There were all the Marys, you know, the Queen Marys, hosts of smaller ships and battleships of all sizes and abundance. It was really marvellous. It's a sight I'll always remember. They came right round the bottom of the Cape, and I suppose they were going up to India and Burma and so on, and the Middle East, of course. Anyway, at Cape Town, I was ordered to vacate all the RAF. That's, we were on one deck, all 3,000 of us. We're on one deck of the ship. And this was to enable King George of Greece to get on board with his retinue. And then we were, from the Cape Town Castle ship, we were transferred to a Dutch ship, the New Zealand, which left Cape Town on the 26th in company with a Polish ship, the Batora. You'll have heard of that. It's now a cruise liner, I believe, which it was notorious then. It was always breaking down, and we were forced to keep running zigzag round the damn thing to avoid the U-boats. Anyway, we eventually arrived in Lagos, West Africa, on the 4th of September and transferred to the Rolling Duchess, as she was known, as the Duchess of Bedford. All the ship's crew was sick, even the captain, but except me, I was always very good at sea. We left Lagos on the 8th of September, arrived at Freetown on the 13th, and then we left Freetown on the 25th of September at high speed, as we were very prone to U-boat and aerial attack from Dakar, which was just round the corner, then held by Vichy French and used as a base by the Nazis. We sailed out into the Atlantic to catch a convoy route coming across from America, you know, to catch a convoy, and to get convoy escort. En route to this convoy, we were spotted by Dorniers. Three of them came out of the sky one day and attacked by U-boats called up by them, but fortunately they missed. Rolling Duchess was quite a fast ship and she managed to slip through. Eventually arrived at Liverpool on the 11th of October and disembarked. That was the story on the way home.
Now, you were in Iraq when the war broke out.
Yes.
When did you first see action in Iraq during the war?
At the Battle of Basra.
When did that occur?
It was in early 41.
Why did this battle take place?
The 10th Army Corps had arrived from India, landed south of Basra with General Slim in command, and they decided to take the seaport of Basra. I was detached. I was sent by my section commander in command of the section of armoured cars and told to report to General Slim for secondment. I was seconded to him and I was to take my instructions from him.
In whose hands was Basra at this time?
In the Iraqis' hands. The Iraqi army, the Germans had actually assembled the Iraq army just above Basra, and they were holding Basra. We went in, having laid down the battle plans, General Slim told me where he wanted my armoured cars positioned and what role he wanted me to play as a backing role to the 3rd Brigade of Gurkhas. We went in at dawn, and we came up against much stiffer opposition than we had thought. There was an Iraqi troops barracks there, and of course the Germans had brought an army, Iraqi army, down from the north of about 2,000 to strengthen. And actually the Arabs put up a very good resistance. I was quite surprised, really, but by the ferocity of their resistance. And I think General Slim was as well. I thought it would be just a walkover, you know. But we fought for... I think we fought till about midday from dawn. And I was told by General Slim to go out and take this Iraqi police post, because the Iraqi police were just as powerful as the Iraqi army, you know. They played a very aggressive role during the campaign, and they were very courageous too. I'd gone around and taken the Basra police station with all the arms and ammunition and prisoners back to General Slim's headquarters. And then after that, he'd stationed Gurkhas at strategic points like bridges all over the city, and I'd got armoured cars in position as well. And then I was told to go and ensure that all the Europeans were okay. Well, having been in Shaibra all those years, I knew where all the Europeans were. You see, I used to go and visit them very often and stay the night sometimes. So I went round and, there were bank managers and trade exporters, managers and all that kind of thing. The McQuirters come to mind. And I went round and brought them all into the safety of the camp. And of course, after that, they were posted off home. They wouldn't let them stay in the country. It was too dangerous. There was nobody to guard them, you see. So that was Basra. The Gurkhas suffered quite a few casualties. Fortunately, we didn't get any. Bangs and scratches, but I mean, no actual casualties. But the Gurkhas lost quite a few Indians. Pinned down by a lot of machine gun fire. Well, after that...
The Battle of Basra, the next battle you were involved in was Junction. Could you describe that one?
Well, it's a bit of an exaggeration to call it a battle. It was just a skirmish, you know. I was told by General Slim to recce to see what the position was at Junction, because they wanted to secure the railway, of course. So I took 3 armoured cars, and we came in at various angles to the junction and took them by surprise. But I was also taken by surprise, because I thought there would be quite a contingent of Iraqis there, with possibly with some German backing. But as it happened, there were 3 men who'd probably seen or heard our approach, suddenly shot out of the junction station, jumped into an open wagon with a machine gun in the back and started blazing away at us. And we blazed away back, hit them, and they went up in smoke. They were all killed. And I then reported back to General Slim. I naturally recce'd on a few miles further in case there were any forces over the hill, the enemy forces that I hadn't noticed. But we returned to Army headquarters and reported to General Slim that Bird Junction was secured and all was okay. From there we proceeded north, and the next skirmish we had was at Duania. And as I remember it, we were proceeding up the road, up the, no, sorry, we were on the desert, and there was a road running north to the right of us, which was near the Shat al-Arab, and would be covered with, it had a screening for the enemy anyway. And General Slim wanted us to recce over to see exactly what was there. Well, we went across in line abreast, which I later changed to a V formation. I was in the leading car. My machine gun was shot out of the gunner's hand. The bullet ricocheted down my back and ripped a bit of my shoulder. It's just a flesh wound, you know. And all my cars were getting in trouble, and I realised we were up against some pretty heavy firepower, which turned out later they'd got Bren guns, Czechoslovakia made Bren, which we hadn't got. They'd been supplied by the Germans, and they were plonking away at a rate of about 1,500 rounds a minute, or whatever it was at us, you know, and we'd just got these old Vickers, and we couldn't use the Lewis because we couldn't go outside on to use them on the turrets. So we just had to stick to the Vickers water cooled. They were getting overheated, and some of them were jamming. They were very old guns anyway. Should have been replaced long since. So I was forced to give the order to retreat in the end, but not before I'd inverted the V, incidentally, and brought the back cars up. But we'd managed to establish that there was a pretty strong enemy force with a few tanks along this road, which, of course, we hadn't come up against before, and caused a bit of a dithering in the ranks, because there were thought to be no tanks out there, but the Germans must have smuggled a few in. Well, after that battle, we were proceeding to Damascus. General Slim decided to ignore this lot over on the right, and we just pushed on. I estimated that it wouldn't be enough threat to cut off his supply route at the back. In any case, the supply route was pretty well up behind us. So we just pressed on. And I think it was the next day or two, this aircraft landed from Shaiba. And General Slim called me over into his tent, and he said, you ought to get back to base, Henry. And I said, oh, what's all this about? I was looking forward to going on this Damascus campaign with the Syrian campaign. And he said, I'm sorry, but your air officer commanding absolutely insists you've got to go back. And he said, I've got no power over him, so away you go back. So I reported back to Shaiba and to the station commander. And he told me that I'd done almost a double tour in Iraq. Senior medical officers had told Sir John Dorbiak, who'd come across from Greece by then, that if I wasn't posted home, they wouldn't be responsible for me anymore, and that was it. And I said, well, you know, you need experienced people. I'd left a very inexperienced officer in charge of the armoured cars. But then there was a section commander back at base who never got his nose off the ground, so, you know, he stayed at base and sent me out with the cars. So it was really up to him. He should have gone out. Whether he did or not, I didn't know. Because, as I say, I was ordered onto the ship at Basra the next day. Told to get out of the command quick. That was it.